the last image that most Americans have of the Vietnam War is that of a helicopter lifting off of the rooftop of the U.S. Embassy in Saigon. But that is really where my story began. I was born in South Vietnam just 8 months after the fall to the communists in April of 1975. But this is not a story about the Vietnam War. This is a story of what happened next to the more than a million people left behind, including my family. Before the Vietnam War, my father's family was very wealthy. They owned a rice milling empire that's probably worth millions of dollars in today's value. And after the fall of Saigon, we lost everything overnight. Our business was confiscated, all the property was taken away. We were evicted from our own house and forced to live in a small farm in the rural Mekong Delta. And it was out there 8 months later that I was born, in a little shack. My family was left behind and we had no way out and nowhere to go. Staying behind, though, was not also an easy thing, because when we stayed behind, my parents saw that there was just no future for their children. With oppression from the new regime, being forced to live in a little place that had no electricity, no running water, my parents realized that they had to do something about it. By this time, we've heard stories about people who try to leave, and these are the people who left as boat people, where they would sell everything they have, get into these little rickety boats, and go out to sea and just hope to make it to one of the neighboring countries at the refugee camps. And so we left on a large boat with about 290 people, and out at sea, we encountered attacks by Thai pirates. They raided our boats, assaulted and robbed us. And this boat actually made it to the beach of Malaysia. And there we hoped to be admitted to the refugee camp. But instead, we were essentially imprisoned on the beach of Malaysia. It was also there that the men were beaten on the beach of Malaysia, including my father and my uncles. We were forced to march on the hot sand for many days. And the conditions were so difficult that my mother actually suffered a miscarriage while on the beach of Malaysia, and there she almost bled to death. We were rejected from the refugee camp, and then eventually our group was then placed into four small fishing boats. These are derelict fishing boats that weren't even functioning. And then there the Malaysian Navy towed us out to sea. Out at sea, they cut the ropes and left us to die. But out at sea, my father had, I think, his first connection with the Creator. Because while out there, he looked around and saw his entire family dying of thirst. There was no hope in sight, and it was at that moment that he got on his knees and prayed. And my father shared that almost immediately after he said that prayer, the skies turned dark and rain came down, and we were offered a temporary quench in our thirst. But still, what we needed was more than that. And so we continued to drift. And then eventually, this was when we came across World Vision, Operation C-Suite. This is a story about my family, but it's a lot more than that. It's an American story. It could be anybody's story.
That sounds like a hopeless situation. Little boy Vinh Chung, 3.5 years old, forced to leave Vietnam. He finds himself jammed into a boat with 93 refugees lost in the middle of the South China Sea without water. And the boy's father, in his book, does something that he had never seen him do before. He kneels in the middle of the boat and he prays, I know there's a Creator God. I know you created us, and you don't want us to die like this. So if you're listening, please send rain. And within minutes, the sky darkened and it rained. A reprieve. But on the sixth day, that heat and that fear returned. So could God intervene and help such a hopeless situation? We know about hopeless situations, don't we? There's this horrific school shooting. I'm still thinking about it. 19 children killed, 2 teachers, There's voices all across the country calling for action. They want gun restrictions. I think that restricting legal gun rights is going to fix the problem. And then Christians are calling out prayers to God, and so many voices, celebrities that you know, are making fun of Christians who are praying because they don't believe prayer works. They say, we want real action. So many say these words, things will never change. Maybe you've said that in your life. It's kind of a defeatist attitude, but we say nothing can be done or nothing can help. People look at their lives and they say, nothing can be done. There's no use trying. People look at their marriages and say, there's no use trying anything. Nothing is going to change anyway. Well, we've been studying Esther. And when we started the book of Esther, it could have very easily been concluded the same thing. We started with King Xerxes, the king of Persia, and with a wave of his hand, he dispensed with a queen. With the impression of his ring, he condemned an entire race. But the story we saw last week took a remarkable turn. When Haman, the man who made all the plans and the decree, was executed. So God was at work. But even though he was killed, it didn't stop the decree from carrying weight and from going to be carried out. You know, that's how it is with so many things. They're partial victories. You could have a good court victory, but it never really stops evil. Things are never really completely fixed. As we see today, God is still at work, even though it seems hopeless. And we see that God can soften the hardest heart. So turn with me here to Esther chapter 8. And I'm going to start with the first three verses. That same day, King Xerxes gave Queen Esther the estate of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came into the presence of the king, for Esther had told how he was related to her. The king took off his signet ring, which he had reclaimed from Haman, and presented it to Mordecai. And Esther appointed him over Haman's estate. Esther again pleaded with the king. Falling at his feet, weeping, she begged for him to put an end to the evil plan Haman the Agite, which had devised against the Jews. So the king is told the whole truth about Mordecai being a Jew and how he's related to Esther. The king gives all of Haman's property to Esther, and he gives his signet ring to Mordecai. And Mordecai takes up residence in Haman's house, and he assumes the role of second command in the nation. So Esther goes to the king and asks for things to be changed, but it could not happen because a law could not be changed once it was enacted in Persia. She's pleading with her people. So the king asks Mordecai to write another decree. And this is in verse 8. Now write another decree in the king's name in behalf of the Jews as seems best to you, and seal it with the king's signet ring. For no document written in the king's name and sealed with his king, with his ring, can be revoked. So you couldn't change the law in Persia, but you could write another one. So Mordecai writes another decree. It's sealed with the king's ring, sent to all the provinces, and made known throughout the kingdom. But it's interesting what the law is, and this is in verse 11. It's very telling. The verdict gave the Jews the right to assemble and protect themselves and kill armed men who might attack them and plunder them. I just want to tell you, this sermon was done before that shooting took place. But did you catch that? This law gave the Jews right to defend themselves, to fight against enemies who would try to kill them. And just as an aside, our country was founded on the right to bear arms, self-protection, with no limits. It's very dangerous to disarm a nation where the only people with the weapons are the government and the criminals. And other efforts right now to take this and to minimize this rule, it's all done in the name of safety. But you could argue, as you look at the scriptures, that the self-defense is a right that you can argue from the Bible. But God saw to it that His people would protect themselves. When the law was announced, the Jews were rejoicing. They felt they could protect themselves, and it turned the tide. The common people in Persia, they were sympathetic to the Jews, and the decree was sent out 9 months before the day when the Jews were to be annihilated. So the Jews had 9 months to prepare. But don't miss the huge turnaround. If you've been with us in our series in Esther 4, remember there was mourning and fasting among the Jews. But by chapter 8 of Esther, they were rejoicing. Mordecai, remember, had been walking around with sackcloth. And now he's wearing the king's robes. God can turn things around. And maybe you find yourself in a powerless situation. Maybe you're dealing with pain. Maybe you're dealing with grief. Maybe you're dealing with illness. And it's taken all of your joy. Maybe your marriage is an unhappy relationship. Spouses say, well, they're not the same person I married. But remember this now. All married people. Everybody changes. You change, they change, everybody changes. But if you find yourself struggling, you don't know where to turn, remember, this is the story of the Scriptures. You read about Abraham, you read about Joseph, you read about Moses, you read about Joshua, you read about David. They were all God's people, and they were all facing impossible situations, and God acts. So today we're going to finish up the story of Esther. Let me give you a couple of takeaways to encourage you. One takeaway, you cannot predict how God will intervene. Remember, the Jewish nation had once been great. Now they were scattered. Now they were captive of a foreign nation. They didn't have a temple. They didn't have a homeland. They didn't have a leader. But unexpectedly, God raises up Mordecai and Esther, and Mordecai took a stand, and Esther took a risk, and God delivered. And that's the story of the Scriptures. Godly people have trusted God to act, and He acts. But He does so usually unexpectedly, and sometimes after a long wait. You remember the story of Abraham and Sarah, and God promised her a baby, and she waited, and she waited, until she's elderly. She'd given up on this promise, and then she's told she would have a baby, and she's in the tent, and she laughs to herself. And God told Abraham, why did Sarah laugh? Of course, Sarah said, I didn't laugh. But Genesis 18:14 has the question that we should all ask. Is anything too hard for God? So think about your problem, your trouble, whatever it is. Does God ever walk away from a problem? When you ever prayed to God with a problem, does He ever just say, this is way too hard. I'm just walking away. I can't handle that. No. Because it says right there, nothing is too hard for God. So we move on to Esther chapter 9, looking in verse 1. On the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, edict commanded by the king was carried out. On this day, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, but now the tables were turned, and the Jews got the upper hand over those who hated them. The enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them. It says, but now the tables were turned, and the Jews got the upper hand. There's other translations that say the exact opposite happened. Here's another translation. The irreversible occurred. Their plan was overturned. Whatever translation you use, it's a plot twist. And it's completely unexpected. Sometimes we get so wrapped up in the circumstances that we're facing and they don't make any sense. And we think God has forgotten us. Or we think the problem is so big that nothing can be done. Or we look at our leaders. I'm going to get close to home here now. We look at our leaders and we see disastrous decisions that they're making. And we feel helpless. And so we don't pray. because nothing can be done. But I want you to listen to Proverbs 21:1. Proverbs 21:1 says, "The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. Like rivers of water, he turns it wherever he wishes." Now, what challenges us is that we can't predict the outcome. But God is God. He can turn things around on a dime. So we must pray and we must live in faith, knowing that He's at work, even if we cannot see it. Like the 93 refugees in the China Sea, it was a life and death situation, and World Vision chartered a World War II landing boat, and they loaded it with food and fuel and medical supplies, and they rescued this boat carrying all these refugees, and that was the Chung family. About one day before they would have died, they were saved. They gave them medical treatment, they gave them food and water, and surprisingly enough, they also gave them Bible studies. In fact, there was even a church service on the boat. And Mr. Chung, not a religious man, wanted to know why these people had rescued them. So he and his family ended up becoming Christians. God works in mysterious ways. If you read in Esther chapter 9, you'll see that there's still opposition to the Jews. There was over this new decree, and there was a war. And the Jews ended up killing 75,000 people who opposed them, and we don't even know how many Jews died in this. But they were able to prevent this annihilation, and they were able to be victorious. But you just don't know how God is going to intervene. Now, the second takeaway, make efforts to remember what God has done. So God uses Mordecai, Queen Esther, and King Xerxes to accomplish this amazing reversal. But he doesn't want the Jews to forget. So look over here in Esther 9, verse 20. Mordecai recorded these events, and he sent letters to all the Jews throughout the provinces of King Xerxes near and far, to have them celebrate annually the 14th and 15th day of the month of Adar, as the time when the Jews got relief from their enemies, as the month when their sorrow was turned into joy, and their mourning into a day of celebration. He wrote them to observe the days as days of feasting and joy, giving a presence of food to one another, and gifts to the poor. One of the main reasons the book of Esther is included in the Bible is because it gives details on the Jewish festival of Purim. Mordecai and Esther commissioned this annual celebration so the Jews would always remember what happened. So letters were sent to all the provinces. This was to be a time of feasting, a time of joy, giving presents to each other, and giving gifts to the poor. It's interesting that the book of Esther ends not with a celebration, but with a call to remember. It was scheduled for the day after the scheduled execution, symbolizing that that day had come and gone and the Jews had survived. So I did some interesting research this week on Purim celebrations. I think I would enjoy the Purim celebrations because they're quite a big affair in many Jewish communities. There's food, there's reenactments, and one tradition, and I know I would like this, is pastries baked. They bake special pastries and they fill them with jelly hidden in the middle as a reminder that God is often silent and often hidden in the ways that He works. But God can make beauty out of ashes, and He can bring joy out of mourning. Now, we know about times we set aside in our country. We have holidays we set aside, Memorial Day and Independence Day and 9/11. But we also need to make times when we can remember what God has done. Jesus gave us a celebration to remember what He did for us. Jesus took the bread and broke it and said, "This is my body given for you." And He took the cup and He said, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood poured out for you." These are precious words. They're a reminder of a terrible thing that happened a horrible thing that was done to Jesus. The cross is a horrible image, and yet we remember it. I don't know, has anybody in here ever been to the town Enterprise, Alabama? I've never been to Enterprise, Alabama. But in 1919, they erected a statue that looks kind of like the Statue of Liberty. It's there today. And her arms are extended up, but she doesn't hold a torch. Instead, she holds a huge 50-pound bug, a boll weevil. This bug was added 30 years later to the monument. Now, why would you have a statue to a bug? The plaque reads, "In profound appreciation for the boll weevil and what it has done to herald prosperity." The story is that Alabama had a thriving cotton industry, but the boll weevil arrived from Mexico and it completely devoured their industry. And nothing could be done to stop them. But there was a man named H.M. Sessions who saw what was happening. He was traveling through Virginia and he saw fields of peanuts. And the boll weevil could not destroy the peanuts. So he bought some seeds and he brought them back to Alabama. And he sold them to a man who planted them and made $8,000. Well, word spread and farmers jumped on the idea and the money and the prosperity returned to the area, but it never would have happened had it not been for the boll weevil. So they made a statue and a 50-pound bug. Well, maybe you've had some boll weevils in your life. Or maybe you've had some Hamans in your life who were evil or who harmed you. They come to us from our past and they distract us and they destroy our peace and they destroy our joy. But we can't forget those painful things from our past. We need to make an effort to remember them and remember how God used them for good. Many years ago, I was in a retirement facility. I was visiting with one of the residents. He was a real happy man. Didn't really speak English. I couldn't really understand him. And he pulled up his sleeve and there was a tattoo from a concentration camp. He'd grown up and he was a Jew and he was in a concentration camp. He was a very happy man and he was in a very wealthy facility, so things had worked. I never got his story. But that tattoo is a reminder of a childhood trauma that he faced. But it turned out for good. We make intentional efforts to remember such things. We know that God can turn bad things into good. And so often when I look at my life and I see some of the blessings that I have, I realize I never would have got them without pain and without trauma, because God can turn things around. If you're a follower of Jesus, you're promised that God is working things out for good. Well, it certainly worked out good for Esther and Mordecai. Chapter 10 is only a few verses long. Ironically, it's about the greatness of Mordecai. Verse 3 says, "Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Xerxes, preeminent among the Jews, because he worked for the good of his people, and he spoke up for the welfare of all the Jews." Now people, when they hear the story of Esther, they often forget about Mordecai. So much attention is focused on Esther, but that's not the story of Esther in the Bible. Mordecai played a very pivotal role. And Mordecai is like Daniel. He faithfully served a pagan ruler, and he did good for his people. Well, God turned things around for the little boy, Ben Chung. He arrived in America with nothing but clothes on his back. He didn't know a word of English, but he learned it. And God was working in his life. He ended up playing football in high school, and he ended up graduating from Harvard. And now he's a dermatologist. But interesting enough, and more importantly, he's a Christian. That was that book, the beginning. He wrote a book and he talked about how Jesus Christ turned things around. And God can turn things around. Christians, we can be sure of this. Whatever we're going through, God can turn it around. So here's a scripture that I know you've heard many, many times. And I want you to listen to it again. This is Romans chapter 8 and verse 28. When you see this verse, I want you to see four quick things that you can be sure of. Number one, it says, we know God works. No matter what's happening in your life, no matter what's happening in the world, God is working. Even if you don't know about it, He never sleeps and He never stops. Number two, we know God works all things. All things. This Greek word includes all things, not just good things, not just the best things, not just the easy things. He works all things. He works all things together for good. That's number three. Not for our pleasure, not for our comfort, not for our enjoyment, but for our good. I mean, after all, God is good, and God has a plan to bring good. So we shouldn't get swept away by stress and hopelessness and bad news, because remember this now, bad things are not forever, and God can use them for good. And number four, we know God works all things together. This is it, number four, of those who love Him. Good things happen to those who trust God. It isn't for everybody. Only for those that follow Him and obey Him, they can claim this promise. I like Max Lucado's quote. He says, you are in the hands of a loving God who's the author of life, and He is working for your ultimate good. So whatever you faced in your life, and I'm sure we faced a lot together, and whatever scars you have, even from your childhood, if you love Jesus Christ, He is working it out for good. Christians, we have the message of hope. It doesn't matter what you've been through. It doesn't matter what you've done. There's hope and there's forgiveness, but we must come to Him. If we come to Him, He can help us. He can deliver us. He can forgive us, and He can turn things around. But we have to come to Him. He promises to work it out for good. So we have our song of invitation. And as I'm looking out, I'm seeing Christians out here today. Maybe you look at your life and you say, I need to rededicate my life. I've not been walking the right way. I've not been walking with Jesus, and I've been off. Or maybe you just need to place your membership here, become an official part of our church here. But just remember, God is working for good. Let's all stand as we sing our hymn here.